On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food.
These shrimp sheds are hidden in plain sight on residential streets or behind walls. We found three different ones where many people were locked inside, hundreds. It was a bad situation, both in terms of human rights, but also it was pretty unsanitary, with overflowing toilets and unclean water. People were just locked inside, wanting to leave.
That's Martha Mendoza talking about the investigative reporting project she's been working on for the past several years at the Associated Press. It's called Seafood from Slaves. The remarkable multimedia series reveals the ties between forced labor in Southeast Asia and the seafood that ends up on the American table. Hi, Martha.
Hi, how are you?
To put this whole conversation in context, shrimp is the most loved seafood in the U.S. We eat 1.3 billion pounds of it every year. That's about 4 pounds a person. And that Thailand dominates the shrimp market, and half of Thailand's shrimp exports come to the U.S.
Correct.
Before we get to shrimp, what other U.S. goods are known to be products of forced or slave labor?
Well, there's a list put out by the U.S. Department of Labor of some 300 different items that they say there's reason to believe they're the product of forced or slave labor. And these range from medical devices to the clothes we wear. In each of these, what's tricky is tracking a specific situation where someone is enslaved to the U.S. store shelves. And that's what we set out to do in this case with all different types of seafood and cat foods and pet foods.
So what was the action or the thing that caused you to start investigating when you did?
My colleagues, Margie Mason in Jakarta and Robin McDowell in Myanmar, were really frustrated because they had done stories, as had others, about former slaves, people who had been rescued and who were kind of giving testimony to the fact that this was an ongoing practice. And there was not a lot of response to these stories. And the stories would describe how the seafood that these people caught must get exported to the United States because the U.S. imports so much of its seafood. But again, not a lot of response. And so we decided what we needed to try to do was find people who were currently enslaved and get their stories. And the second piece that we needed to do was literally figure out exactly where that fish ends up, what the supply chain is. And we were warned that both of these were going to be near impossible to get, but we felt that that was going to be the way to make an impact.
How did you find the people and how did you track the fish from slavery to the source?
Well, for months and months, Margie and Robin turned over leads until they heard about Benjina, which is this remote Indonesian island that's so cut off it's unreachable for part of the year due to stormy seas. Soon after they arrived on the island, AP journalists found hundreds of Burmese slaves, some locked in a cage, others buried under fake names in a company cemetery. And the level of desperation was just staggering. Some men hadn't been in contact with their families for years or even decades.
Did they just stumble upon these people as they walked around the island, or did they slip into warehouses?
Mm-hmm. Actually, we had been thinking that there might be slavery and labor abuses in a particular species of fish. And so she spent a couple days talking to people about whether they were involved in this particular fishery. And it wasn't until a few days in that she realized that these were almost entirely Burmese people she was interacting with, and that there was something really strange about the situation on the island and these people. And so she called Esther in Yangon, who's a translator and journalist, and Esther joined her. And when these men saw Esther, it was like seeing a little sister, and they just gathered around her and began telling their stories to her.
So when they were on the island, people knew the reason they were there was to get at this story. They weren't pretending to just be interested in that particular fishery?
No. Initially, Robin was telling the people on the island that she was just interested in doing a story about the fish operation there and the fish company that operated off the island. And then she went over to the school and, you know, was talking to the kids, like definitely not telling the authorities what they were doing. Usually, journalistically, we do our best to avoid being surreptitious. We want to be upfront about what we're doing, but in some situations we need to. And in that case, what we do is inform our readers through our articles about why we were needing to be more subtle in our approach. So Robin and Esther were quietly talking to people about their situation. They spent a night in the woods. The men who were locked in a cage, actually, they were warned to go nowhere near them as they approached. And so they gave a GoPro camera to a sympathetic dock worker who carried it up and had the men who were locked in the cage talk into the GoPro.
Wow. I understand that GPS software and planes were involved in tracking the products from Southeast Asia to the U.S.
So Robin and Esther are seeing these people and realizing they're enslaved. And they saw the fish they were catching being loaded onto a refrigerated cargo ship. That refrigerated cargo ship has a satellite tracking beacon aboard. And we were able to, once that boat left Benjina, track where that huge load of seafood went. And when it arrived in Samutsakon, which is just south of Bangkok in Thailand, we were able to meet this boat in the back of pickup trucks with tinted windows and follow the seafood as it was unloaded and taken to factories and processing centers in Thailand. And then we used customs bills of lading and other business records to see where it was getting shipped from those businesses in Thailand to the United States.
So we're talking about slavery on the ships and in the actual act of fishing. Then we're also talking about slavery in processing plants, like with shrimp, the peelers.
Yes. So when the Thai government said that the abuses all occurred on foreign territory, we turned to Thailand itself to see if there was any veracity in that. And we had heard from human rights groups that indeed there was a lot of labor abuse and human trafficking in the shrimp processing buildings. And so in the course of just a few weeks, really, we found three different shrimp peeling sheds where people were locked inside. They were at the mercy of their Thai bosses. They were trapped. Most of them were Burmese migrants. Children worked alongside adults. One girl was so tiny, she had to stand on a stool to reach the peeling table. And they were woken up every morning at 2 a.m. And for the next 16 hours, they would stand in the factory that owned them with their hands in ice water, peeling shrimp, pulling out the guts, heads, and tails, and deveining them. And these shrimp are bound for overseas markets, including U.S. grocery stores in all 50 states and all-you-can-eat buffets in the U.S.
You just used the word owned. Are these people actually bought by families who sell them? Or do people sign on with them like indentured servants?
So the way people end up trapped in situations of human trafficking, and particularly in the seafood sector, are varied. But the most typical way is that a broker would come to a village and say, hey, I can get you a good job in another country and you can have some money. And so they will pay a fee and then they will be taken by the broker. And many of them then describe being locked up or sold at that point. And the person who buys them, then they tell the worker, you got to work off this debt you owe me. And in many cases, that debt, they are never able to actually pay it off.
So do people escape?
People escape. And when they do, sometimes they are picked up and brought to relief shelters. And that's where we had interviewed escaped slaves. And that's where we realized we needed to find people who are currently captive, because industry's response to their testimony is, yes, but you're talking to someone who's free and the problem has been solved. And we knew that was not the case.
In fact, I remember reading in one of your stories that a young couple who escaped rather harrowingly ended up in prison.
Yeah. So this is a problem with human trafficking. And this was really, really sad. These people were in a shrimp peeling shed and the authorities came and raided it. And the authorities in Thailand then treated the people who they had rescued as illegal immigrants. And so then they were put into jail as people who were undocumented and illegal.
It's just is like worse and worse and worse. Where do we find seafood produced from forced slavery in the U.S. supply chain? Give us some names.
One place we tracked it back to was Santa Monica Seafood in Los Angeles, where you are. They were surprised and disappointed and definitely wanted more details about what we had learned and how we had learned it. That was actually a very typical response. But the supermarkets where we track this back to include Stater Brothers, Albertsons, Safeway, Kroger, restaurants like Red Lobster. We had reporters in all 50 states literally go to supermarkets and identify the brands in those markets because while we knew they're familiar brands, we also wanted to identify that they were the brands and a product of Thailand.
Are there any Thai processors out there that are doing the job without resorting to slavery?
The largest Thai processor is called Thai Union, and they are by far the biggest. They own Chicken of the Sea. And they, after our story, hired 1,200 shrimp peelers from pre-processing sheds and brought them in-house and have provided them with jobs, pay, their kids go to school, and they have more security and more rights. So for their shrimp processing, Thai Union has definitely cleaned up its operations. The problem is this is one of these huge industries where there's a lot of outsourcing, and so it can be very hard, they say, to keep track of where every one of their subsidiaries is getting every one of their shrimp processed.
And the shrimp could be mixed up. So it could be that half the bag is from one processor and half the bag's from another.
Yeah, this is a problem that we hear a lot about, which is that it's hard for us to know everything that is in our shipment. But what the authorities, law enforcement and legal authorities say is that if your supply chain is tainted, in other words, if one shrimp from a slave enters a whole truckload of shrimp, then that whole truckload is now tainted with modern day slavery.
I understand that at the end of last year, Nestle disclosed that its Thai suppliers were abusing and enslaving workers, and they vowed to force change. Have they, in fact, been doing that? And are any other companies following Nestle's lead?
You know, they all say they are. Nestle did something pretty unique. And when we first, in early 2015, brought to Nestle evidence that we had found slavery in the supply chain of their products, they said, we know and we're working on it and this is a terrible thing and we will let you know, you know, what we find out. And then what they did that was very unusual was they audited their supply chain. That is not unusual. Many companies do that. But the auditors found human trafficking and they released it publicly. That's very unusual. The next steps, I believe, are underway.
So let's talk about what governments are doing about this. Has the European Union or the United States imposed bans?
The European Union has given Thailand what's called a yellow card. And if you think about it in soccer terms, that's one step away from the red card. That it's a warning that if they do not clean up their labor practices, their seafood will be banned from the European Union. And then the European Union was supposed to come out with a final ruling at the end of 2015. They keep postponing that and kind of advising Thailand very gravely to clean itself up. This is a $7 billion export industry. And so it would be very serious to them if they got cut off from the European Union. The United States had on the books a law called the Tariff Act that banned import of any product of slave labor. However, one piece of our reporting last year found that there was a loophole in that law called consumptive demand, which meant that products that are the result of forced labor continued to come into the United States because there was a need for it, and there was no other way to get that product. Both parties in both sides of Congress closed that loophole, and Obama signed it into law. And so now you have federal agencies trying to figure out how they're going to enforce a law that says no product of forced labor can be imported into the United States.
Because enforcement is always the rub.
Exactly. However, until now, you know, when I would say, why aren't you enforcing this law? We have published video where you can see this exact product has in its supply chain slavery. The response was because there's consumptive demand. In other words, there's no other way to get Thai seafood, and so we have to allow it to continue. That loophole no longer exists. And so I believe there is a strong inclination to come up with some high-profile cases to enforce this law.
We can always turn to Mexican seafood.
Sure, and domestic. I mean, there's shrimp, there's Gulf shrimp, there's West Coast prawns, and there's plenty of domestic seafood as well. It's very expensive, but you have a better chance of knowing where it comes from.
And there's a reason it's more expensive.
Yeah, because in some situations domestically, they have to comply with labor laws as well as health and safety laws.
So do you think that the best way for consumers to be sure they're not eating seafood with ties to forced labor is to actually ask at a restaurant or a seafood counter where the fish or shrimp is coming from?
Yeah, I think that that basic question not only is a good way for them to make sure that they are not contributing to the problem by spending money that ends up going to people who are using slaves. So certainly asking the question can help that. But I also think that question alerts restaurateurs and seafood stores that this matters to customers and that they in turn need to be asking those questions of their suppliers. And part of the problem that's unique to seafood is that it takes place so far from shore. And as overfishing has pushed stocks further from shore and pushed fishing further from shore, there's just not a lot of oversight of what's happening aboard a boat.
It just seems endless and insolvable.
Well, there's a lot of traceability initiatives that are being enacted now that had nothing to do with labor supplies and everything to do with sustainability and environmental issues, which have been a big issue in the seafood sector for a long time. Everybody's been well aware of sustainability problems. And so they began enacting ways to trace where a fish comes from. A potential consequence of that may also be that they'll be able to say who caught the fish or what the circumstances were with the labor.
The series of articles was just stunning and shocking. Thank you for doing all that work.
Thanks, Evan. We have more stories coming on this. So, I mean, that's what I hope is that we can keep going and keep going, raising awareness, and that people like you can continue to raise awareness, because that's what's inevitably going to bring about change. Some of these Burmese migrants even said to us, you know, if people knew that we were catching this shrimp, or that we were peeling these shrimp, or that we were locked inside, if people who ate it knew, we don't think that they would be buying it. Engaging people and letting them know about it, it's not an impossible situation to stop. It is solvable, but it takes people at all levels.
That was Martha Mendoza talking about the AP reporting project, Seafood from Slaves. It just won Selden Ring and George Polk Awards. You can hear the team of AP reporters talking about their project at USC on April 15th. Find out more on the Good Food website. So where does all this leave us when it comes to sustainably sourcing our favorite crustacean? That's next when our show continues. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. Support the podcast you enjoy by donating at kcrw.com/join. And thanks.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. The downside to knowing more about where your food comes from is that nagging moral sense telling you it's time to make a change. So if we want to eat shrimp that's produced sustainably and locally, what are our options? We posed the question to Paul Greenberg, who can make a book on seafood as engaging as any mystery novel. His James Beard Award-winning book is Four Fish, The Future of the Last Wild Food. Hi, Paul.
Hey, Evan, how are you?
It is so great to have you back.
Great to be on the show.
So why has shrimp from way around the other side of the world become our default way of eating shrimp?
It's a combination of things. I mean, one of it is just that we just like shrimp. They are relatively easy to deal with when you compare it with other seafood. And that's why we eat, you know, 4 pounds of shrimp per person per year, as opposed to the next most consumed seafood, which is salmon, which is around a couple of pounds. So it's really easy to peel and eat that way. It also does not taste fishy. So Americans are really abhorrent to the idea of fishiness on their plate. And so this way, with shrimp, they can eat something that is technically seafood, but which doesn't taste like seafood. So I think that that's largely what's driving it. I mean, the American palate, let's face it, is not an adventurous one. Shrimp fits that particular bill.
So that explains why we eat shrimp, period. But why, when we go buy it in the store, are we choosing to pick up these bags of shrimp that come from so far away rather than shrimp that's sourced in the U.S.?
So the main reason is we here in the United States do not do a lot of what's called aquaculture or fish farming, mostly because we don't seem to want to set up fish farms near our shores. There's lots of coastal complaints about that. And so as a result, we end up sourcing a lot of our seafood. You know, something like 90% of American seafood comes to us from abroad in Asia, in places like Thailand and Vietnam, where these labor issues are coming up. They have a very pro-aquaculture governments, and they really try to push aquaculture so that shrimp ends up being grown in a lot of these places in Southeast Asia. The other thing about these economies is that, you know, they don't cost a lot of money to hire people. And on the low end, some of the people working in the industry are actually slaves. So, you know, you put that price point in front of a lot of low-end supermarkets, and of course, they're going to take the cheaper option.
I grew up at a time when shrimp was a super luxury food. It was something that you would only eat if you went out to a fancy restaurant.
Oh, me too. Like the shrimp cocktail. That was the be-all, the end-all of the appetizers.
Or, of course, if you went to Las Vegas.
Or even Las Vegas. Then it was free. You just had to lose all your money at the gambling table.
Exactly. So this expectation that something like shrimp should cost so little that it shows up at all of these all-you-can-eat buffets where the price is so low. What happened to give us that expectation?
Aquaculture really lowered the price. When you think about it, when you catch wild shrimp, it's a lot of work. You can end up catching about 10 pounds of other stuff to every pound of shrimp that you actually bring to market. So you have all these people that have to sort through all this wild detritus, throw that back into the sea. Shrimp has a very short shelf life. It goes bad really quickly unless you clean it immediately. So once you throw aquaculture into the picture, you don't have the bycatch issues. You have processing that can often occur right next to the farm. And then, as I said earlier, you also have the cheap labor. So all of that combined means you can get a cheap frozen product quickly to American consumers. And yes, you're right. Once upon a time, the shrimp cocktail was a luxury item. But now, if you look at just in terms of dollars and cents, it is much, much cheaper almost than any other seafood to bring to market.
So if we want to avoid this slavery issue, is there a way of determining the provenance of where the shrimp comes from?
Well, so seafood in general is very difficult to trace. The average piece of seafood changes hands about 7 times before it reaches the consumer. It's one of the most heavily traded commodities in the world. Shrimp, of course, being the most preferred seafood of Americans, it's incredibly traded. What you need to do is look for supermarkets that have very clear supply lines and have traceability programs in place. There is one study that's put out annually by Greenpeace called Carting Away the Oceans, and it rates supermarkets according to their seafood sustainability standards. Paramount to those standards is traceability. So while I can't guarantee that the number 3 or 4 supermarkets, which I think they list as usually it's Whole Foods and Safeway, are usually the 2 most trusted supermarkets in their list, while I can't guarantee that they would have no slavery shrimp, what I can say is that they do have clear lines of custody that help you trace back shrimp to a farm and to a processor. When you go to the low-end cut-rate supermarkets, the low-end cut-rate Chinese restaurants, things like that, that's, I think, where you're going to get into murky waters.
So if we want to have shrimp that is more locally sourced, where do we go? What is the health of the Gulf shrimp industry, for example, right now?
Well, so there's two tracks that I think the American consumer can pursue, wild and farmed. And as you mentioned, the Gulf of Mexico does have robust supplies of brown shrimp and white shrimp. The BP oil spill doesn't seem to have affected the shrimp populations too much, and they seem to be in pretty good shape. There is a limited amount of shrimp like that. It is costlier than the farm shrimp that you get. And also there are all those issues about bycatch that if you're not willing to accept the fact that sometimes more than 2 pounds of wild stuff gets killed for 1 pound of shrimp brought to market, then maybe that's not your choice. The other thing which I'd like to see more of is indigenous American aquaculture of shrimp. Now, this is a very new thing, and it's just starting to get going. But the state of Illinois, for some strange reason, has a lot of what are called closed containment shrimp farms, places where they're not in touch with the outside environment. They're basically just in a tank. And you can do that with shrimp because shrimp grow really quickly. And these kind of things are cropping up all over the place. There's a place in Boston doing it. I met a really interesting guy up in Newburgh, New York, who's using, I think, a floor of an old motorcycle factory to grow shrimp, and then he brings it fresh to New York City. So it's kind of amazing that you can have fresh shrimp, unfrozen shrimp in New York, grown in New York. Personally, I'd like to see more of that kind of thing take shape.
Is the bag, like the 1 pound, 2 pound bag of peeled frozen shrimp, is that sort of something that should set off alarm bells in our head of, oh, I should really take a look at this? I should look at the label.
If you're getting it at a cut-rate supermarket, then yes, it probably should be something you take a closer look at. The incidences that have been reported around slavery seem to be focused on Thailand. That seems to be the place which is getting a lot of migrant labor coming in from Myanmar, and those are the people that are being impressed into slavery. So Thailand might be a tip-off, although, you know, there are perfectly good Thai shrimp operators, but nevertheless, that's where the investigation has focused. You know, you there in Southern California have access to the spot prawn, which only has a limited season in Southern and Northern California. It's a terrific shrimp. It's a wild shrimp. It's actually caught in traps rather than in trawls, so there's very little bycatch. It's super delicious, super just lovely product. They actually harvest it after it's spawned, so it's just going to die anyway. So it's kind of the perfect seafood. So if you can get your hands on some California spot prawns, grab them up.
Thank you so much, Paul. As always, it's a pleasure.
My pleasure, Evan. Hope you have a great rest of the day and maybe eat some good, healthy shrimp.
Thank you. That was Paul Greenberg, author of Four Fish and American Catch. Speaking of local seafood, we've got pictures of Santa Barbara spot prawns cooked in salt and rosemary on the Good Food blog. In a minute, we move on to shellfish. Stay close.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Now let's turn our gaze to how we can cook shellfish at home. For some tips, we head to the Santa Monica Farmers Market. Take it away, Laura.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. It's the beginning of April. We're at a market on a beautiful sunny day. And I'm talking now with Brian Sheard, who's the executive chef at Taste on Melrose. Brian, you've been at Taste for 7 years. You love the market. You're here today. Tell us what you're shopping for and what you're going to be making with it.
Today I'm shopping for fennel, and I'm making Point Reyes blue cheese steamed mussels with sautéed fennel, a little bit of white wine, butter, and herbs. It's delicious.
Is fennel a seasonal vegetable?
You can get it pretty much year-round, but it's always best in the spring.
I've seen them later in the season, and they just cut off the bulb, and the fronds are nowhere in sight. But you're saying you use those fronds, too.
Yes, I use the fronds, and I pick all the little leaves off because it adds great flavor and color to the dish. And it's just so aromatic when you do that too by hand instead of just chopping it.
Yeah, we're hearing more and more about how the greens are actually the most nutritious part of the plant. And I think a lot of times they're very flavorful.
Yes, they are. And it's also a lot of part that gets just thrown away because people don't think about using that. They're great in stocks and soups, and you still get that anise flavor from the fronds as you do the bulb itself.
And when I get fennel, it's a root. I mean, it grows right in the ground, and usually there's a lot of dirt way down in there. So how do you clean it?
I will usually cut it in half and cut the heart out of the fennel, and then that will break apart all the leaves and then just wash it really well. And then dice it up to whatever I'm going to use it. If I'm going to shave it for a raw salad, I'll shave it first and then wash it.
And so the dish you make with these mussels, how does that go together?
So I start off with a little bit of extra virgin olive oil, garlic. I saute the fennel and then I add the mussels. Just slightly saute them because I want to keep a crunch on the fennel. Then after I add the white wine, I steam them until they open up. Then I start adding the Point Reyes blue cheese, a bunch of herbs, butter, salt, pepper, and it's delicious. I got to say, it's one of my favorite things. And then it's so much juice and everything, and you got that vibrant flavor of the fennel coming through. And then when I finish it with the fennel fronds, it gives it that bright color and great texture.
And how much blue cheese are you putting on top?
For the dish at the restaurant, we usually add about 2 ounces.
So when you're eating the mussels out of the shells, how do you get that? Is the blue cheese like completely melted at this point? You're just kind of scooping up everything and composing your bite by bite?
Yeah, it's like the blue cheese is pretty melted. We'll garnish it with little extra chunks on top. But yeah, it's pretty much all melted. So you have this really creamy blue cheese sauce with the fennel. And then, yeah, you scoop it out with the mussels, pick out the mussels. You got to make sure you get a lot of that sauce with every bite. And then always serve it with some bread so you can soak up all the extra stuff.
Sounds fabulous. That was executive chef Brian Sheard at Taste on Melrose with this wonderful, original, unique dish that combines mussels, fennel, and blue cheese. You know, I've been paying attention to fennel since we've been talking to Brian, and I see fennel at a lot of stands around the market, one of which is Coastal Farm from Santa Paula. Mark Carpenter is the farmer, and they have beautiful fennel with these soft fronds. Now, Mark, you've had fennel for years and years and years, and I remember you used to bring the little baby 4-inch long whole fennels because the chefs were asking for it. Today, your fennel is big and lush. So tell us, how do you grow fennel?
Back in the old days, we used to plant it direct seed, and we'd plant it very thick, and when the chefs wanted the baby-sized fennel, we would go through and thin it out and sell it by the pound to the chefs. And it's pretty difficult to do direct seeded because the weeds kind of grow faster than the fennel, of course, and it's just very time-consuming to weed it and thin it all out. So nowadays, we just do the transplant and transplant it, and the fennel grows much faster than the weeds, so it's much easier for us to do it that way.
And are the transplants, are they grown locally?
We do. They're not even a mile away from our farm. And right down the street makes it really easy for us. Just turn in the seeds, and a few weeks later, we get the plants.
What, you give them the seeds?
Yes, I buy the seeds.
Oh, I see. Yeah. So how big is the little fennel plant when you stick it in the ground?
It's about 6 inches already with a nice root system. And they just really kind of take off right away, especially when you get some rain.
Mm-hmm. Which we've had a little bit of.
We've had a little bit of it, not quite enough. Yeah. But, yeah, any little bit helps.
Yeah. And it looks really big. So how long ago did you plant that?
Oh, that was probably planted 3 months ago. It takes its time, and the chefs really like the they like it to swell up to nice and fat.
And is it a year-round crop?
It does not do well in the hot weather, so we try to grow it in the fall and the spring. Mm-hmm.
And how many times will you plant it, succession plant it?
We plant it 3 times throughout the year, once in the end of summer and one time in the fall and one time in the spring.
Okay, so this is your spring planting?
It is, and I have one more planting after this coming. So mm-hmm. When this one's over, I have one more batch before summertime.
And it's got a mild licorice flavor. You were telling us that it's not your favorite vegetable in the whole world.
This is true. I don't really care for the licorice flavor. It just reminds me of hard liquor or something, or, yeah. or candy. I don't care for it.
Well, and that's exactly what people like about it, though, is that licorice flavor. And the fact that the bulb can be sliced and cooked and that the fronds can also be used either with the dish or with something else completely.
It is edible for me when it's roasted. I do like that quite a bit with some onions and fennel. I think that's pretty tasty. But, yeah, the tops are good on fish and teas and whatnot.
Mark, the fennel seeds that you use, are they to plant? Are those the ones that people use in cooking, do you know?
I really doubt that. These are like special Italian seeds that we pay a lot of money for. So I would imagine the seeds that they use for cooking is more like off of a wild fennel.
Mm-hmm. So after the fennel goes to flower, the little fronds then ultimately turn into a flower, we've seen people here actually selling fennel pollen. Where does that come from?
Well, when the plant bolts and goes to flower, it ultimately puts off this big yellow, kind of spindly looking flower. And I assume they just shake it off onto a tray and collect it.
Well, thanks, Mark.
Thank you, Laura.
That was Mark Carpenter, and he's a farmer up in Santa Paula. He's been growing fennel for a long time, and he's got lovely other greens. And, of course, he's got the wonderful heirloom tomatoes in the summer, too. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
You can find a recipe for Brian Sheard's steamed mussels with Point Reyes blue cheese, white wine sauce, sautéed fennel, and grilled garlic crostini on the Good Food blog. We stay close to the sea today, even as we turn to Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. So, Jonathan, where are we headed this week?
We're going to Venice Beach.
What's new there?
It's not especially new, but it's a restaurant called Dudley Market, which is on that little stub of Dudley Street that people have been going to Piccolo on for a while.
Whenever I hear the word market in the name of a restaurant, I have a certain expectation. Is that expectation fulfilled?
I suppose so. It was a convenience store before it was turned into a restaurant, you know, last year. And you can actually go and buy things off the shelves. In fact, I've never been able to go out to lunch or dinner there without buying things off the shelves.
You're their perfect customer.
Possibly. I mean, they sell the Apricot Lane eggs, which are they're the best eggs in L.A. at the moment, right?
The best eggs. I just gasped. They're worth the crazy price.
And you can get both the chicken or the duck eggs. They have a good selection of the Rancho Gordo beans. They have some interesting chocolate. You wouldn't go there as your usual grocery, but you can definitely pick up some provisions.
It would lead one to believe that they're using those eggs, for example, on the menu, which is pretty fantastic.
They are. It's a very, very market-driven restaurant, which of course means that the dishes I'm talking about may or may not be available by the time you go to it.
Okay, so take us on a little tour of your dinner.
The restaurant is run by Jesse Barber, who we last talked about at a place called Barnyard, not far from there in Venice, and who's worked in Portland and worked at Tasting Kitchen here in Los Angeles. He's the sort of cook that will put a plate in front of you and you will almost fail to figure out how the food has been cooked until you take an actual bite of it. You almost gasp at how concentrated and clear the flavors are.
Because it's one of those situations where you look at the plate and you think, oh, this is just figs on a plate, but then it's much more complex.
Much more complex. For example, there's, I guess, a version of gnocco frito, the fried puffs of dough. But they're tiny and they're sandwiched between slices of scallop that have been, I can't even tell whether they've been warmed or lightly cooked or somewhere in between. But it's perfect because you get the crunch and the warmth and sort of the coolness of the scallop. And there's just couple of dribbles of, you know, those Calabrian chilies and oil you can buy at the better Italian grocers, which are nice. They have that sort of funky, almost high quality to them. It doesn't seem like much. It seems like something you could do off shelves, yet the contrasts of the textures, the temperatures, the flavors, that sort of sea funkiness that you get from super fresh scallops as opposed to the sort of more vegetable fermentation thing that's happening with the chilies. It's just nice. It's a really smart dish.
Yeah, and I love that he's pairing the gnocco frito with the really thin slices of scallops rather than the usual prosciutto that's laid on top of them.
Right. I mean, it's the automatic call with prosciutto in Emilia-Romagna. He has mussels that he showers with grated cauliflower that you think is Parmesan cheese for a minute. And it almost has the umami thing going on that Parmesan has. And it's strange. It shouldn't work, but it does. He has roasted marrow bones with crumbles of feta cheese that are bright pink, like Pepto pink. Apparently they've been like tossed with Campari. And it sounds like an absolutely revolting combination. You know, the bitterness and the slight sweetness goes with the tang of the cheese. And, you know, you do with bone marrow, you're dealing with something that's just so numbingly rich. It has to be the single richest food it's possible to eat. And it works somehow.
That sounds weird and wonderful. What about the sort of big plate part of the menu?
He does his own pasta, and one I especially liked was the tagliarini noodles, like thin, flat, with a kind of pesto made with stinking nettle leaves. And I'm always happy to have somebody that is not me prepare stinking nettle, because it always bites me. Does it bite you?
Always bites me, but, you know, in the end, I don't care because I love them so much.
And it's garnished with, like, the fried leaves. It's a nice dish. Other things they have there that are great are a Boudin Blanc, which is sort of very bratwurst-like, but with maybe a more developed pork flavor that's seared off. And I guess this time of year they're serving it with asparagus tips and sort of reduced berry juice, though when I was going, it was mostly Brussels sprouts. The vegetable plate is always one of the better things there. The last one I had was just the tiniest spring onions with tiny roasted turnips and kale leaves. I know kale, sometimes people serve them. But it was served on this rough mash of green peas that were barely cooked, just part cooked, like sort of smashed and apparently enhanced with reduced pea juice. So you ate it and it was more pea than pea.
Wow, what a nice ode to spring.
Definitely.
Sounds like a wonderful place to eat.
Yeah.
You really enjoyed it.
Yeah, it was a place I kept trying to figure out excuses to go back to. It doesn't always happen.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. Cash rules everything around me. Cream,
get the money. Dollar, dollar bill, yo. That was Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times. We've been talking about Dudley Market. Text the words good food to 69866, and you'll get a text that will tell you where to find all of Mr. Gold's recommendations. Next, we learn about different methods for growing oysters. Stay close.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW. The famed Portland gourmand James Beard once wrote, "At their best, oysters are eaten on the half shell with nothing to enhance them except lemon, a bit of grated fresh horseradish, or a mignonette pepper sauce. If you do not like the natural flavor of oysters and find you must cover them with quantities of red cocktail sauce, then perhaps you shouldn't be eating them." Unquote. Author Cynthia Nims adopts a different approach in her book Oysters, Recipes That Bring Home a Taste of the Sea. Hi, Cynthia.
Hello, Evan. It's great to be with you today.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you back. So what do you make of Beard's opinion of oyster slurping?
You know, I think his point's well taken that oysters are a unique and special product and, you know, covering them up too much sauce, you're kind of missing the point. But the point that I like to make is if it takes a little cocktail sauce or horseradish to get people to try oysters on the half shell for the first time, that's fine. I'm just hoping over time folks might pull back a little bit on the cocktail sauce and really get to know and love oysters in their just extraordinarily sort of unique flavor form that they offer on the shell.
How many species of oysters are there?
In North America, we grow 5 different species of oysters. And what I think is kind of cool about our West Coast is that we do, in fact, grow all 5 of those species, even though a couple of them aren't native to our waters here. In fact, there's only one oyster that is truly native to the Pacific Coast, and that's the Olympia oyster, the teeny little one that is often, you know, not much larger than a silver dollar. And they're pretty prime and prized. They're not very widely available. So when you see them on the half shell menu, I highly recommend folks give them a try. So the Olympia is the only native. We also grow the Pacific oyster, which is by far the most commonly grown up and down the coast from California all the way up to BC and into Alaska. We rarely see them called Pacific oysters on menus. Sometimes in stores you will, but usually it's given a place name like Totten Inlet or Neatarts Bay or Fanny Bay, because oysters are such a representative of the specific water that they grow in. So they tend to be given a place name.
And that's basically because of the anatomy of an oyster and what the water is to an oyster.
Exactly. A lot of sea creatures obviously live in the water and are somewhat a product of the place that they grow, but oysters take that to a really extreme degree because they open their shells and they are filter feeders. They're filtering 10, 20, 30, sometimes up to 50 gallons of water a day. So that water that's passing through their gills literally does contribute to the flavor and character and texture maybe even of the oyster, the mineral makeup of that water, depending on what river, maybe estuary it's near, or the salinity level of the water. The phytoplankton that they're consuming will contribute maybe slightly greener, crisper, more vegetal flavors. It's really and literally a product of the water in which it grows.
There are 2 basic methods for growing oysters, bottom culture and off-bottom culture. Can you explain each technique?
Yeah, bottom culture is the most basic and rudimentary and sort of ageless. It's the little baby seed or, you know, larva of an oyster lands on the beach somewhere. It attaches to something and sets up its home, you know, where it's going to grow. And it literally just sits on the beach and is, you know, subject to the tides and the, you know, the weather. And it grows barnacles and it gets toughened up by being tossed around in the tide. And you literally don't have to do anything. And when they're off the bottom and they're grown in groups like that in a bag, the water more evenly circulates around the whole population in that bag or bin so that the oysters feed more evenly, which is great. So there's a little bit more access to all the food. It also allows the grower to have a little bit more influence on the end product. You know, they can move an oyster from one area to another. I don't know if you've heard of the term tumbling, but tumbled oysters are those that have been shaken up and sort of agitated in the course of growing. And the oysters are shaken so that the little teeny fringe of new shell growth on the outside of the shell is broken off. And it doesn't harm the oyster because that's not part of the shell that's actually holding the oyster meat in, but it's that teeny bit on the outside. And the oyster goes into this sort of response mode of creating more shell to replace that little bit of broken off shell. And it becomes a deeper cup and a firmer cup and it often a larger meat. So the off bottom, again, gives growers a little more variety in terms of how they produce that oyster that's going to end up on our plates.
How long does it take for an oyster to go from spat to harvestable size?
Well, it's going to depend some on the species and in the area where they're growing. It's not too common to have an oyster harvested much before a year and a half or 2. It seems to me that, you know, 2 to 3 years is a little more common, especially the beach grown. I think they might take a little bit more time.
It really is fascinating that such a strange little animal can be grown in this way. I'd love to talk a little bit about food safety because I think one of the things that keeps people from embracing the oyster on the half shell aside from the texture, which seems to scare people, I've never really right. understood why, is this idea of eating a raw food. So first, I guess I would ask you if this old adage of eating oysters only in the months with the letter R, is that still true or is that somewhat of a myth?
Well, it's definitely true in its original context, I guess I'd say. The months without R are the summer months, obviously, which tend to be warmer in this part of the world. Traditionally, the warm waters are what induce spawning in oysters. And so they'll go into reproductive mode. And not that that's a bad thing. It doesn't make the oyster harmful to eat, but it does change the texture of the flesh. So it gets a little softer and it's often called milky, a little softer, not quite as delightful an experience on the half shell. But also, I would say traditionally, long before, you know, refrigeration and great transportation, it was probably also just safety in terms of once the oysters were harvested, if it was July or August, they might not even hold up that well. So it was probably a double precaution. These days, there are oysters that are known as triploids, which are modified just very, very slightly so they don't reproduce naturally. So when the waters warm up, those oysters are not induced to spawn. So their flesh stays firmer than their cohorts that might, you know, be spawning. So the whole summertime don't eat oyster thing is a little bit outdated in that so many of the oysters on the market, I don't know the percentage, but I know it's pretty common that these days that triploid oysters are harvested through the summer. So that's much less an issue.
And I think the best purveyors of oysters and certainly restaurateurs who really care about quality want the customer to have a wonderful experience, and they're not going to serve something that would be less.
Absolutely. There are so many checkpoints in place to assure that what we see in our restaurants and what we see in our supermarkets are of a quality that we can feel pretty safe with. There's a tagging system. Every single bag of oysters that leaves a production facility has a tag on it that is kept on premises wherever that bag ends up, whether it's a restaurant or a retail store. And you can even ask to see the tag to identify what water it was from and when it was harvested.
So what is your favorite preparation for an oyster?
Beyond just an amazing oyster on the half shell that is just glorious in its pure state, I think honestly, one of my very, very favorites is grilled oysters, partly because grilling is just already such a fun and evocative and enjoyable process, and you're likely going to have some other delicious grilled food while you're there. But the opportunity to cook an oyster and still have it sort of be in its almost purest form, you know, it can be just as easy as setting the oyster still in its shell, just right on the grill, and leave it there long enough, you know, a few minutes until the shell pops open a little bit, and you just flip that top shell off, throw on a little, you know, lemon butter or whatever, and you're good to go. So I think that's pretty wonderful. I got to fall back on the old classic pan-fried oysters. I absolutely love simply coated, you know, flour, breadcrumbs, whatever it might be, and quickly pan-fried with a delicious homemade tartar sauce. I think, you know, I'm an old school gal, so I kind of like those classic old school preps.
So if you're going to do pan-fried oysters, do you buy fresh oysters and shuck them, or will you use oysters that come in a jar that have already been shucked?
I am a huge proponent of the jarred oysters, which maybe is a little bit of a surprise to some folks because it's a shortcut and it's not quite as pristine as coming right out of the shell. But on the flip side, having been to a lot of production facilities where they're jarring these oysters within yards kind of almost of where those oysters were grown, I know how high the quality is in those jars. You don't take them out of the jar and put them in a half shell and slurp them. That's, you know, wouldn't go that far. But I think jarred oysters are a really high quality option.
Well, I want to thank you so much. It's been great talking with you.
Oh, gosh, it's my pleasure. Thanks so much, Evan.
We've been talking with Cynthia Nims, who wrote Oysters, Recipes That Bring Home a Taste of the Sea. Find her recipe for oyster sliders with togarashi slaw on the Good Food blog. While you're there, there's a great Q&A I did with Seattle Times food writer Bethany Jean Clement. It's about pesticide use on oyster beds. Our conversation might surprise you. We close out the show at sea.
Did everyone see the bite, though, and saw what it looks like? Is that exciting? Did it get everyone's heart going a little bit? Like, there's a fish, oh my God! Even me, a million of them. So as a little kid, I've been addicted to fishing since my first memories. That's all I ever did was fish. My father brought me fishing. Every present I ever got was about fish. I have fish ties, fish shoes, fish hats. And I'm still excited every time I see a fish come over the side.
Meet Ben Hyman. If you shop at the Santa Monica or Hollywood farmers markets, you've probably seen him. Tall, sandy blonde hair, his hat and t-shirt always repping his company, Wild Local Seafood. Our executive editor, Jillian Ferguson, went out fishing with him last month. She brings us this postcard from the Santa Barbara coastline.
We usually start fishing at first light, which means we leave the harbor an hour or so before light. And a lot of trips, we're going for multiple days, a majority of the trips. We come back when we're loaded up, so to speak. Right now, we're affixing lead balls or lead weights to a six-hook red rock cod rig that we make custom. We're using cut squid for bait. Of course, California caught USA processed squid. And we're going to drop it down and do drifts over the areas that historically hold red rock cod for my boat and other boats. The schools move around in different areas, different depths. But it seems like as a fisherman, a lot of it is in like a flurry kind of fashion, meaning you get the fish hot and heavy for a short period of time. They all have their own kind of personalities with how they bite, when they bite. It just never is the exact same. So you have to always have like an open playbook for what you're doing and be willing to kind of change things around and move around. So a lot of thoughts going into play. And for a captain, for a guy like myself, there's a lot of like thinking and questioning. I call it the shoulda, coulda, Carls or the shoulda, woulda, Wills. You know, you always think maybe I should be going the other direction. Maybe we should be somewhere else. Even right now while we're talking, because the fish haven't really started biting yet, in my brain, it's like, should we go over here? Should we go over here? Should we change the colors up? There's always a lot kind of going on. Let me put a weight on and we'll catch one of these things.
How far are these going down?
Yeah, about 290, 300 feet. Every single red rock cod of vermilion you've seen is caught like this, either mechanized or old school crank hand reels. Some of these too, like red rock cod's pretty exciting, but if you saw our king salmon, when they come up one at a time, they're just so big and beautiful. It's just like overwhelming how awesome of a fish they are. Same for our white sea bass or these big halibut. Even these vermilion, they're gonna be really bright red, beautiful, nothing like the colors they have, on top of the excitement of the bite. There's fish on already. Angel's already got fish on. Are you on, Angel? We're on here, guys. That's the vermilion. Yeah, buddy. This is fun, you guys. This will be the start of our day. Eat some sandwiches and do this all day till your shoulders are hurt, and we talk all day. It's the same. It's about fishing, skateboarding, some surfing, depending on the crewman. If we catch, 50, 60 fish, 70 fish in a day, that's a good amount for the markets and a good amount for the wholesale accounts and takes a lot of work. It's kind of old-fashioned elbow grease to get things done. The harder the work, though, the more you're catching, usually the more fun it is. So those days where you're just, like, beat tired and you feel like your arms are going to fall off and you're just so sick of shoveling ice and loading the fish up, that's always the best feeling at the same time.
Find out what Ben reeled in at the Wild Local Seafood Stand at the Santa Monica, Mar Vista, and Hollywood Farmers Markets. Or visit him at his first brick-and-mortar store. It opens April 11th at the Ventura Harbor. If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com, via iTunes, or anywhere you download podcasts. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's mobile app. As always, many thanks to the Good Food team. That's Abby Fentress-Swanson, Laurel Garcia, Camilla Tse, Joseph Stone, Jillian Ferguson, Ronnie Mickelson, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.